You want to prevent obesity. Here's goal number one and action item number one, recommendation number one is the folks listening to this call, communities, transportation officials, planners, health professionals, et cetera, should make physical activity promotion a priority by increasing access to places. Half the park should not be inaccessible to people without cars.
Redesigning cities. Speedwell Foundation Talks.
At Georgia Tech. Welcome to episode 25 of Redesigning Cities. I'm your host, Ellen Dunham Jones. This is the Speedwell Foundation Talks at Georgia Tech. Today's episode, Redesigning Cities for Public Health, is a topic that the pandemic has brought into ever sharper focus. As architects, planners, designers, we've long been committed to improving health, safety, and welfare. But today, we can't assume that design as usual really does that simply because our design meets code. What does it really mean to design buildings that heal, cities that encourage healthy lifestyles? What do we have to do to help the most vulnerable, least resourced in our communities to thrive? Our speakers today, Michael Murphy and Dick Jackson, have each, in their own way, thought through these and similar questions with very impactful answers. More on our speakers in a moment. First, let me introduce myself. I'm Ellen Dunham Jones, a professor in the School of Architecture at Georgia Tech, where I direct the Master of Science in Urban Design. Today, I am honored to, along with you, get to listen in on a conversation between two inspiring heroes who are continuing to change how their disciplines engage in building healthy communities and come together. Dick Jackson has led the field of public health to research how the design of the built environment impacts health. Michael Murphy has developed a new mode of practicing architecture as a nonprofit dedicated to designing spaces that heal and construct dignity. I can't do either of these men's bios justice in a short period of time, as I really want most of the time to go to them speaking, but here goes. It is a great pleasure to welcome Michael Murphy to Redesigning Cities and to Georgia Tech as the new Ventulette Professor. Usually, when Michael takes the stage, it's so that he can really share his remarkable work. His nonprofit architectural practice, Mass Design Group, is devoted to designing architecture that heals and constructs dignity, both through remarkable hospital designs that lift entire communities, initially in Rwanda, and memorials, such as the stunningly powerful Memorial to Peace and Justice in Montgomery, Alabama. Winner of the 2021 Firm of the Year Award, Michael and Mass just came out with a new book, The Architecture of Health, Hospital Design, and the Construction of Dignity. I encourage everyone to look up Michael's work and fall in love with it. Because today, instead of asking him to show his work, I've asked him to prompt the conversation with Dick and teach the rest of us what kinds of questions architects and planners should be asking public health officials. Dick Jackson is going to tee off the conversation. How many pediatricians and epidemiologists do you know that are honorary fellows of the American Institute of Architects and of the American Society of Landscape Architects? And that's not even counting all of the honorific positions he holds within public health. Richard Joseph Jackson, I call him Dick, is Professor Emeritus at the Fielding School of Public Health at UCLA, where he was chair in environmental health science. A pediatrician, he has served in many leadership positions with the California Health Department, including the highest as the state health officer. For 9 years, he was director of the CDC's National Center for Environmental Health and received the Presidential Distinguished Service Award. There's so much more I could be saying, but instead, I'm just going to turn it over to Dick to tell us himself.
I had loved when I was at CDC working with the folks at Georgia Tech, and actually one of the co-authors of our first book came from Georgia Tech, Larry Frank. So this is my theme, that we are facing systemic disorders and we're going to have to stop isolating ourselves in our own disciplines and really work across with each other in a much more collaborative way. The 20th century is over, folks. Over-specialization, it helps for a while, but it doesn't solve the big challenges. Three of the biggest threats in our lives. One is old age. It is the biggest risk factor for any negative that occurs in death and other negatives in one's life, the senior center. Two is the COVID epidemic, the pandemic. And virtually every one of us knows someone who's lost their life at this point because of the pandemic. And it's really absorbed a lot of our time and been very damaging to our economy and quality of life. But then the third one, which I fear will make COVID seem small, is climate. And I won't go in depth there, but I hope that Michael and I can really talk about it more. I will tell you the hardest day of the year 2020 was the day that we thought we were on Mars here in the San Francisco Bay Area. I live in Berkeley, when the sky was red from the fires going on. I pushed for the name Joseph in my middle name, partly because it relates to this man. He was a fighter pilot in World War II, flying over Iwo Jima. Above is his plane when it had crashed. He was able to, after 3 weeks of hospitalization, came back from the end of World War II, had three babies in 1949. His breathing stopped in 2 days because of polio, leaving my mother with three little boys and in very difficult financial situation. And we were supported by Uncle Joe, and then eventually my stepdad, Joe. So I go by my Joseph as well. And I think probably, and I mentioned my early life, that it really pushed me in the direction of pediatrics. I understood how early things in one's life can affect you for the rest of your lives. Also, when I was in the intensive care nursery there in San Francisco, I saw a number of children from the Central Valley of California who had birth defects. And because partly I had moved back to New Jersey after my father's death, the reality that the environment can shape our health became very profound to me. And I spent the next few years doing, first I did infectious disease epidemiology after my public health degree and working with CDC. But then I moved more towards environmental health, chemicals in the environment, and 10 years working on pesticides and farm worker health and other such issues in California. One of the big lessons in pediatrics is that children are not little adults. And we pediatricians know when you look at a little child, you're looking at one frame in a movie. You're not looking at a static situation. And we spend a lot of time on what we call anticipatory guidance. You're going to expect to see this, mom, because this is going to happen. And you got to childproof the house. And you have to realize that children eat and drink 3 to 4 times as much per pound of body weight, which means they are literally immersed in their environment in ways that adults are not. They really keep their distance. Very few of you roll around on the floor naked with your hands in your mouth, and yet pretty normal behavior for a toddler. In my time in public health, and I really got beat up a few times because I'd be told, oh, you're just pushing for the nanny state. You're just trying to control other people's lives. You heard this, right? And yet the purpose of public health, and that's where my career evolved into, was public health is about creating conditions, assuring the conditions where people can be healthy. I can't force you to stop smoking, but I'll do the best I can to make the conditions of that building, of the restaurant, and other places to not have smoking in it, not to have passive tobacco smoke. And a lot of my time at CDC was spent on documenting chemical levels in people who didn't intend to have those levels of PCB or DDT or nicotine byproducts or lead in their bodies. It came from their environment. I had worked for CDC for a couple of years. I had worked on smallpox eradication in India and was assigned to New York for a couple of years, but then went off back to California. And then in 1994, I came back to CDC. And here's me being sworn in by Dr. David Satcher, MD, PhD. And Dr. Satcher is one of my heroes. He lived in Anniston, Alabama, a poor community not far from Montgomery, where Michael's wonderful memorial and Mass's wonderful memorial is located. And David's childhood was in a big family. They were poor, very challenging. He was about 5 or 6 years old and developed whooping cough. And anybody that doesn't believe in immunizations, you never want to see a child with whooping cough. And it goes on for a week or more, and the child is desperately ill with gasping for air. Well, little David Satcher could not go into the hospital because he was a Black child. And the reality of that kind of racism and impact impacted him as much as polio impacted my own life. And the importance for justice in medicine was very palpable to him. And when I began to pursue other issues, because I was going to be the head of environmental health in the United States then, he was very resonant when I started talking about asthma and its higher impacts on poor populations. You know, people see the headquarters building, and Ellen has been over to the CDC headquarters by Emory many times, I'm sure, but the CDC Environmental Health Center was over in Chambly, a town to the north, on an old Navy site. Two buildings on the left were gone, but by the time I was there, we still had all those Quonset huts, those half-curved buildings, and some of them had mass spectrometers in them. We had the laboratory that did the Agent Orange studies and other such things. One of these spectrometers, a tandem mass spectrometer, cost a couple $100,000. The roof leaked and the building was a mess, but the quality of the laboratory and of the laboratorians, the people that worked there, was really world class. And so I quickly thought, well, I had all my priorities around pesticides and environment when I got there, quickly realized one of my big priorities was really to go after the funding to fix the facilities. I had lived about 15 years here in Berkeley before I moved, and my kids had gone to an old-fashioned 1920s, 30s school. We have three boys at the time. And when people look for a place to live, the three big things, and this is very American, is you look at cost. Can I afford it? Can I afford the mortgage? Safety and schools. And so we ended up living north of the perimeter because those had very good school scores. And I didn't really know Atlanta that well, and I could not afford with one income, three kids in private school. But we also wanted a subdivision with a swim pool and a swim club because it was every child ought to have a sport. But we discovered that the schools in many parts of the United States, particularly in the South, are often built at a distance from where people live. And the boys' high school did not have a sidewalk within six blocks. They had to be driven to school. They went to North Springs High School, and it was really a terrific school in a lot of ways. It was one-third African-American. A lot of the kids came from downtown Atlanta, one-third international and one-third white kids. One of the things they told me is that they really can't make friends in school very easily. It's the after-school activities, the band, the track team. That's really where you made your friends. And yet the African-American kids, many of them had to take the bus at 2:30, 3 o'clock to go home. And if they stayed for an after-school activity, the parents didn't have the wherewithal to get them home. So it really hit me that this is crazy that a child can't walk to school or bike to school. And there ain't no bike racks, of course. So I began to think with my friend Howie Frump about how in American Public Health Association is 150 years old this year. It was founded with a very strong focus on infectious diseases and better housing, safer food, cleaner water, immunizations. And by the 1910s and 20s and 30s, and particularly after the war, everybody thought the urban problems had gone away because everybody got in a car and drove off. And the experimental state and all of that was my home state of New Jersey. Jersey, where Ellen is from as well, and California had even invented freeways. In fact, if you go back to the 1955 opening of Disneyland down in Anaheim, California, you can look over, the camera looks over at Highway 5 going by in the distance, and you see five cars on it. Well, it's never been that way in the last 40 years, believe me. We spend an awful lot of time in a car, and you're sitting in a car, raises your blood pressure, your blood sugar, your risk of a heart attack, your risk of death, and the faster the car is going, your risk of death goes up as well. So cars have not solved all of our problems, even though the head of General Motors said, what's good for GM is good for America. One of the first outbreaks, I'd only been there a short time, we were called and said the bodies were collecting near the morgue in Chicago. And it was during a heat wave. And at first, the political answer was, well, those people aren't dying from the heat wave. There's something else going on. It's just a coincidence. Well, very quickly, hundreds of coffins were counted. It was well over 700 deaths by the time our investigators were going up to Chicago. They had a bit of a political pushback because it was asserted that they were overcounting them. But the outcome of that was a lot of it was due to bad housing and fears of about people's safety. So those Chicago buildings with the flat top roof and the thick walls and the windows that were virtually sealed shut. And if you were in a bad neighborhood, you might even hammered, or dangerous neighborhood, you might have hammered the windows shut. And sitting in a very hot room that was now 110 degrees and then turning on the fan turned it into a convection oven. So even though for my pediatrics, I knew that bad housing could cause lead poisoning, but I don't think we adequately appreciated just how it can cause death from overheating. I will say as a sidebar, it is very unnerving to drive up to the city morgue and see freezer truck after freezer truck nearby. And what we were doing to our environments was making it hotter. Clearly, urban areas are hotter because you don't have the transpiration from the trees, the moisture evaporating, blacktop roadways getting hotter and hotter. You don't have the shade. And by the way, you have air conditioners. They're taking heat from inside the building and pushing it outside. So the curve of heat islands is exactly what you'd expect. Heat's not only bad for you in terms of heat prostration, heat stroke, but it degrades air quality. Ozone levels go up as the temperature goes up. And ozone is a deep irritant to the lungs. It causes bronchitis and it can cause more serious illnesses as well. And when do we tell our kids to go out and exercise? In Georgia, the football games are often in the evening when the air quality is the worst. My son, when he was doing the marathon in Atlanta, one of the challenges there is, you know, long distance runners like being in the country. To do it in the city, I had to drive him across town to find a place where he could do a distance run. So the lack of parks is a health issue. Redlining had reduced tree cover, and that impact had made it hotter for three generations. So bad economic decisions led to bad tree cover decisions. The most appalling story I ever heard about people not liking tree cover was when the Department of Transportation was thinking of taking down trees because if people lost control of their car, they were more likely to get hurt if they hit a tree. You know, I guess if they hit a pedestrian, it wouldn't hurt the car as much. But the American war against trees, and boy, oh boy, you fly into Hartsfield, Atlanta, Jackson Airport, you see the removal of trees everywhere. We've now paved over in America the equivalent area of the entire state of Georgia. And that's how much O2 production has been reduced by that. I mentioned Dr. Satcher, and I was trying to get funding. We had funding for childhood lead poisoning, but we did not have funding for asthma epidemiology, asthma outbreaks. And I was trying to get that funding at the time. And he and I visited a number of homes of children with asthma. And I remember being with him as we went into one home, and there were three or four young children. David Satcher said to the little boy, "Well, what do you do when you think you're getting an asthma attack?" And he said, "Oh, I get this inhaler and I use it." And he, "Oh, okay. And do you take any meds?" "Yes." And then he stopped. The boy stopped and he went into his little room and he came out and he had a shoebox. And Dr. Satcher's looking at him with the shoebox and it's filled with medications. But Dr. Satcher's also looking around the room. And the paint is peeling. There was evidence of vermin infestation. Two or three children were in one bed. They were really suffering from the physical environment they were in. And yet the child was pulling out, "I take this when I'm this sick, and I take this when I really may have to go to the hospital." And I could see tears in his eyes because the medical solution to what are intense environmental and housing problems, the medical solutions were totally inadequate. The Olympic case study is sort of a classic, but people were told not to drive to downtown Atlanta. We all used MARTA to get to events during the Olympics, and there was a 30% reduction in driving, and there was a 30% improvement in air quality. And so Mike Friedman and the folks in the air pollution branch did this study looking at costs of the of asthma during the Olympic period compared with the same period last year and same periods at other times, and improving air quality reduced disease, including asthma in children. And all of this, and even listening to me, you may think you want to take some antidepressants, but how we've seen a doubling in antidepressant consumption in the last generation, fourfold and earlier, but we have created environments, you couldn't dream up an environment that would be better at depressing people than putting them in boxes and reducing their socialization and reducing their physical activity. So in 1996, the folks in the Chronic Disease Center wrote a policy brief for the Surgeon General, which they were set to release, and Dr. Satcher held the meeting, and he had about 20 of his directors and senior staff in the room, and they were presenting physical activity is good for you. It reduces your cholesterol, your blood pressure, improves your mental status, it improves your socialization and your balance and your risk of getting taking falls, and they got it all done, and I finally said, "Dr. Satcher, CDC is not entitled to issue this report." Really looked at me like, "Why are you such a troublemaker?" And I said, "Look, there's not a sidewalk within miles of CDC, except maybe on the Emory campus. There's no bike racks. We do everything we can to discourage people from being physically active. And then we're going to tell them, oh, be physically active? It doesn't make any sense." And Dr. Satcher agreed. Of course, the report was issued anyway, because the fundamental reality that physical activity is good for our health, but we had not had any attention to the environment that was impeding physical activity. I never saw a child with what we called adult onset diabetes. When I was a young pediatrician, it's now half the kids in the diabetes clinic. And diabetes reduces your lifespan by about a half dozen years and increases your healthcare costs in the range of $10,000 to $20,000 per year. So back around the year 2000, 1999, I was driving over to Dr. Satcher's office and looked to the side of the road and saw an elderly woman walking along. She was bent over with osteoporosis. She was carrying a shopping bag, one in each hand, and it was 95 degrees. It was really humid, and I wanted to help her. I didn't do it. I went to my meeting, and all I could think of is if she collapses, dies, the cause of death will be heat stroke, and it won't be absence of public transportation, absence of adequate tree cover. And if she's killed by a truck going by, the cause of death won't be absence of sidewalks. The cause of death will be motor vehicle trauma and not absence of sidewalks and absence of public transportation. And I went back and I called Howie. I said, Howie, I think we've been worried about parts per million and parts per trillion and parts per billion, but we're not worried enough about the physical environments that we build. Our ancestors in public health 100 years ago knew the physical environment was a great risk factor, but we've sort of forgotten it. And so we did a quick look at the literature, and there really was very little literature on how the built environment was shaping human health. So I wrote this piece with my friend Chris Katitsky, and we speculated. It was a monograph for Sprawl Watch, and said how we're building America is bad for people's health. And we were quite successful. 24 members of Congress wrote to the head of CDC and said, fire Jackson because they're crazy. What they're saying can't possibly be true because people in suburbia live longer than people in the inner city, which of course is ridiculous because people in suburbia in general are wealthier than the people living in the city. But the developers have a lot of political power and economic power. So I was called in and they said, Dick, where's your data that shows that all this stuff? Well, there really is no data. And so we began to push to create that data. Also during that time, remember I talked about those buildings that were falling apart, and I finally convinced the leadership, including the members of Congress, that we needed to have new buildings put up in Chamblee. And so I said to the architects from CDC and from personnel management, I want to have buildings with nice big lobbies and stairways on the side so we can get people to want to take the stairs because one flight of stairs a day for a year burns off about the equivalent of 1 pound of fat. And I want people to be able to bike there. And I want the buildings to be connected by covered walkways. The folks in Atlanta don't know that it rains and gets hot, but you know, walkways would encourage people to be outside more. And I deliberately put a picture of my dear friend, Chris Katitsky, who passed away a year or so ago, on his crutches, and he was very instrumental to a lot of the work and gave me a lot of insights into the challenges of the built environment for persons with disabilities. So we began to be activists with the Academy of Pediatrics, wrote a policy brief. Jane Brody of the New York Times wrote a number of articles about the need for kids to be walking and biking to school again. It improves their mood and creativity and other such things. And here's the official policy statement for the Academy of Pediatrics. They're as worried about the social development, the autonomy development in children as they were about the physical development. And I appreciated that position about a better design environment improves physical activity and those outcomes. And thanks to Howie Frumkin, he pulled together this first book that we did on this. And at this point, there are a couple of thousand articles that one can access on why the built environment really matters. So you get called in and if someone says, what do you mean to say the way we build is bad for people's health? The data is now there. And it was data that I used for my four-hour PBS series as well. Ended up in front of a lot of interesting groups. Started with the American Institute of Architects, but then went to the Urban Land Institute and some of the biggest developers in the world, getting them to say stop building around golf courses and start building around places where people can be physically active. This was a big deal one because remember I said I was in trouble because I didn't have any data that showed that bad physical environments presented risks. Well, this was the report from the National Academy of Medicine that said, you want to prevent obesity. Here's goal number one and action item number one, recommendation number one is the folks listening to this call, communities, transportation officials, planners, health professionals, et cetera, should make physical activity promotion a priority by increasing access to places. Half the park should not be inaccessible to people without cars. And any national academies are important. And so the Surgeon General's report came out, and then Chris Kotiski had a lot to do with this, calling for walkable communities. It was not enough to just say be physically active. You need to have communities where you can do it. When my son was a medical student, he went down to Costa Rica, and he sent me a note and said, "Dad, the people in Costa Rica spend 7 times less than Americans do on medical care, and they live exactly as long. 17 to 18% of the GDP of the United States is now spent on medical care, and we live on average about 7 years less. And only about 5 of the increase in lifespan over the last 100 years have come from medical care. The rest has really come from immunization and, I will argue, infrastructure, and to an extent, antibiotics." I just want to say again, I'm so thrilled and honored to be with Michael and Dr. Murphy. Mr. Murphy, how are you? Dr. Murphy, I'll make you a doctor. It's okay.
Thank you so much, Dick. It was incredible to see that presentation. And I'm really honored to be able to speak with you today because your book, Making Healthy Spaces, was incredibly influential to me after I met Dr. Farmer and got the chance to work on healthcare infrastructure as a student of architecture. This was I started graduate school in 2006. I started working with his organization in 2007. We built a hospital called the Bitar Hospital in northern Rwanda in 2008 to 2011. It was an amazing journey myself because I was working with doctors who were not necessarily interested in the excesses of the design industry. They were asking, you know, every design decision that we were proposing, they were pushing back and saying, "Well, prove to us that it has a health impact and we'll do it." And I think it was a really powerful kind of charge to show evidence. You know, if you're going to make decisions around a hospital that are different than what we've seen, give us evidence it'll work. And that sent me and my colleagues on a search for evidence, which, as I think you mentioned, there's very little of. And so your book was a really kind of powerful and important sort of anchor text to show that there is some work going on that overlaps public health and design outcome, design and health outcomes, and the impact on the world that design decisions might have, and that we have to take this more seriously. I wanted to kind of first thank you for that and the ongoing work of your career. It's been influential to me and to my colleagues and to many others. And I wanted to kind of maybe use that as a moment to respond to something you said, which is you talked about the ancestors, that our ancestors knew some of these lessons and somehow we've forgotten them. I think that's a really powerful point and something that, you know, as a student myself, I was looking for this insight and could barely find it. So maybe you could speak to that a little bit. Who are these ancestors that had this insight? Why have we lost it? And what can we relearn today to kind of capture some of that?
One is, I was lucky enough to be invited to give a talk in Italy when my sons were sort of middle school age. And I took my wife and the 3 sons and my recently widowed mother-in-law with us. And we had a little place out in Tuscany, as every American wants. And I went off and did my talk for a day or so. But then the kids hung around Tavernino, the town, and got to really became very autonomous. And went here and there, and they really enjoyed it. They made friends quickly, and they learned a fair amount of Italian. We were only there about 2.5-3 weeks, but when we finally got back to California, they were homesick, and they said, "Why do we live like this? It's so much more fun, where there's so much more interesting things here, and I can get on the bus for a nickel and go into Florence for," you know, it was just amazing. And we've all had the experience of going to the Latin countries. In Italy, they have the Passeggiata in the evening, and you'll see in the central square, the elderly are sitting there talking or playing cards or telling stories, and the little kids are all running around them, and the young men and the young women are walking in opposite directions around the plaza, sort of in the courting behavior. And all of that, it was designed for the fundamental human needs, whether you're young or old or looking for a life partner. And by the way, the food was good. And we've kind of forgotten all of it. Now, you know, we just go to Costco and load up the refrigerator and think, "Oh, I've got an adequate life here." So I will tell you, you're in Boston there, and my father's family was from a town called Hudson, about 30 miles from Boston, and had immigrated and all worked in the mills out there. But the downtown was a place where everybody went. You knew everybody, and they weren't rich by a long shot, but they were pretty happy there.
That's really helpful. So in your life, what were the kind of key precedents that you kind of point back to? Some of the, where you grew up, some of these places that you traveled to, were there thinkers or architects or designers that were intentionally shaping these places that you can really guide us to? And who's doing it now that you think are shaping us anew and discrete ways that are really helpful?
One, and I neglected to mention, slightly off your question, but Andy Dannenberg at the University of Washington has really been, and he was the lead author on the last book on making healthy places. He really is on top of the literature, and he's been pushing the students and going forward. Two is very inspirational to me have been the students. And I will tell you that I was instrumental in starting the joint program between public health and urban planning at both Berkeley and at UCLA, and was involved with it at the University of Michigan. And now there's about a dozen joint programs. And I must say the urban planners welcome the fact that there's public health data, and they like doing that crosswalk. It is actually impelled the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, which is the biggest health foundation in the world, to really up the amount of funding that's looking at variants on this, whether it's parks. How do we push improving neighborhoods so we don't necessarily gentrify? We absolutely should not displace people as we improve the safety, the cleanliness, the order, the amenities that are available to people. When I worked in Michigan, I really enjoyed getting to know the folks who had a vision for reinventing Detroit, and the Kellogg Foundation and a number of others were extremely important in all of that. I think one important leader, and I saw that one of the speakers in Ellen's course, Peter Calthorpe, who's thought a lot about these issues as well, and I met him through Robert Davis's, I think it's called the Pienza Foundation, but he would have these meetings in some of the hill towns in Italy, and that's where I experienced the quality of the life in these places. He's the man behind Seaside, the development along the Florida coast, the Gulf Coast there, which people always know, it's the setting for the movie, The Truman Show. But I love being in the place. Before it got, now it's very full of people and a bit too upscale, but I liked it when it was more homey and you could walk around and people were on their porches and you'd talk to them and the walkways. So those are some places, in New Jersey, I'm trying to think of there are a number of towns that were thoughtfully built that worked pretty well as well.
You mentioned, you're talking at the scale of the city or the neighborhood at the, you mentioned how urban planners are excited or really encouraging the data from public health to improve or at least have evidence for decisions that they're making. When we were working, we were primarily working in the discipline of architecture. And I found those silos between, the building, the region, and the scale of the microclimate and more the planetary climate, that scale, I found it challenging because different disciplines were more attracted to or encouraged to accept the overlapping or intersectional research around health and outcomes. It does seem like there's incredible silos or have been historically silos between who's willing to think about these, health impacts as a key motivation and outcome of decisions that we're making. Can you speak a little bit about some of those disciplinary silos that you've encountered in your own work trying to break through and where the biggest barriers are in your mind?
When I got to UCLA, I went out of my way. I was in public health, but I went over to pediatrics and got an appointment and did a lot of teaching in both the medical school and the nursing school. But I went out of my way to reach out to the Institute of the Environment, of course. Then I was to the urban planning school, and I discovered something I was not prepared for. The architecture school had been split off from the urban planning school about 20 years before because someone had the idea that architecture really belonged over with the arts. And the urban planners, we almost spoke the same language. We really thought about, the subway system under the Wilshire Boulevard has public health issues and planning issues. And yes, you want to have the stations look beautiful and you want to have the architects involved. But the architect embrace of almost a self-motivated, and I don't want to use the word egotistical, sense of beauty was a bit hard for me to swallow sometimes. Frank Gehry was down the road and became involved with the reclamation of the Los Angeles River. But I actually found his art kind of unfriendly. He was asked one time why there was no place to sit down in his opera house, and he just flipped them the bird. He wouldn't even talk about it. So I've had a tougher time with the architects, although as I'm going to say that, I'm going to commend you for something. You know, I was on the board of AIA for several years as a public member. A lot of those people were really very aware of some of these issues I'm talking about. But the very first president of AIA, first African-American president, the institution was like 125 years old. And I think the first woman was about 100 years into it. I think they've been working very hard to be much more open to the future. And our big focus, and this is 10 years ago, was really to get AIA to step up on climate issues. And I think they've really embraced it in a powerful way.
Can we talk about that a little bit? Where do you think, because the built environment is such a huge, has such a huge impact on climate, anywhere, but, you know, estimates between 30 and 45% of all emissions are related to built environment. What can we do? What are the things in your mind that are the most clear steps to be made? And knowing that this, you know, the built environment work, I often call it a long time horizon industry. You know, you make a decision now, and 5 years from now, it's you're seeing it in real time. So we're really working on these much larger time horizons, which of course climate change is a part of that problem. So imagining that future so far ahead. So like, what are the things we need to do now that will anticipate, you know, decisions that might be having to make in 5 years, both at the scale of the urban, but also I think also the scale of the building.
One is, I think there's been a fair amount of retrofitting of existing buildings. And, you know, the carbon footprint's already been created, and rehabbing is not going to create the carbon footprint of taking down, you know, quarrying more and hauling more and creating something brand new. And I loved in your discussion about Rwanda how locally sourced stones and locally sourced materials were being used. And I love the fact that human labor was being used. And I made the half joke about, you know, one flight of stairs a day for a year burns off a pound of body fat. But one of the things we did on the UCLA campus was open up a bunch of the closed stairways, which were really dreary and unpleasant to use, and putting daylighting into them. And by the way, if there had been daylighting in the World Trade Center's stairways, a lot more people would have escaped. So there's good reasons to have daylighting of stairways and people feeling safer. And the young women told me that they liked it because they didn't feel safe on those stairways, you know, with the dark corners and the turns, and the fire doors were solid. When they closed, you know, you were really being isolated. So retrofitting the buildings was very important. I'm going to bring up two big ones, which are very important to me. One, I showed some of the pictures of Los Angeles. Los Angeles, 100 years ago, you could take the red line, the trolley line from where UCLA is downtown. It would take you about an hour. But it was pretty nice, and you got to meet your neighbors along the way. Well, today you can drive along Wilshire Boulevard in a Lamborghini, and it will take you an hour because it's just stopped the whole time. By the way, you probably could get there faster on a bicycle if the roads were reasonably open than you could in a car. So I think, you know, really pushing accessibility for bicycles in New York has made good progress, and other cities have made progress, but there's a lot more we could do. My son, who's a doc in Atlanta that I talked about, commutes by bike, and he has an electric bike, a Boost bike, because he said, look, I can't be drowned in sweat when I get to work in the morning. And he's very grateful for it. He's found safe ways to use side streets and back streets to go back and forth. And there's a big push now. And by the way, I sort of mentioned CDC, but I forgot to say that Perkins and Will was great, the architectural firm. I tried to get because we are the Center for Environmental Health, to get a fuel cell for our power, and I could not succeed with that. We have put in the bike racks and put them near the guard gate, because then their bikes are being watched, which every bicyclist is always worried about whether their bicycle is going to be stolen as well. But I want to go back to the subway for one more minute. The subway under Wilshire Boulevard, which is being built, one is there was a lot of pushback from Beverly Hills because they didn't want the subway to go under Beverly Hills High School. And to make a long story short, we, my colleagues at UCLA, did a health impact assessment that showed exactly what common sense would tell you is, yes, there are negatives when you're building a subway. But once the thing is built, people walk more, they bike more, they socialize more, they save money, and they're less stressed than trying to drive on a roadway. So the health impact assessment really captures it more. One of the negatives about the environmental impact assessment is it looks too narrowly at environment and doesn't look at human well-being, and particularly prospective well-being, adequately. So the high-speed rail that's supposed to go between the Bay Area and Los Angeles and San Diego is costing five times as much as it had. I'm making that number up, but it's very slow progress and very expensive. And it's being held up by environmental impact reports, and because any lawyer can slow anything down. And yet it would be hugely to the health benefit of everybody, including the well-being and economic well-being of those communities, if the thing would be put in place.
I'm so glad you bring to this conversation. I was something I wanted to bring up as well. You're already starting to answer, but maybe we could kind of dig in a little bit here, because there's a really challenging reality to both in terms of community engagement and outreach, but also into getting infrastructure built that improves public health. I would call this the sort of behavior shaping versus the personal choice debate, which is what happens at the community level, you know, which is certain infrastructural investments from public housing to public transport to parks, which might, you know, overall for the public health be a public good, and for the long-term impact of the health of the population, a great good in the health of the climate. And yet we have an incredible amount of public pushback from community meetings that basically have made it impossible to get large-scale public infrastructure built in this country. The flip side of that, of course, is that we in our world are seeking new forms or new ways of getting more and more community engagement. And the questions of equity, questions of like who we're speaking to, the questions of how we do outreach, and the kinds of inquiries that we must demand a sort of top-down planning initiative to require have had obviously fundamental goods like increasing universal access to design, increasing accessibility to, as you mentioned, those with mobility impairments, and obviously reaching out to communities that have been historically marginalized as well as injured by public infrastructure. So there's a lot of reasons and complexity around why we need to have these types of checks and balances in our processes. And yet we are in a kind of stasis of a balloon state where we can't actually invest in these infrastructures. Where do you sit on that both debate between behavior shaping and personal choice, between community meetings that are destructive and community meetings that are productive? How do we navigate in there? What are the tools we can use to, let's say, break through the complexities of those issues?
You know, I was telling that story about the subway and the work on the subway in Los Angeles. And this really comes to a head around the transit stops, the transit-oriented development, because there was a lovely it was an ugly four corners that had gas stations on all four corners, and it was taken over by the Latino population there and became Mariachi Plaza. And there was a music stand, and the mariachi bands would be performing, and people would be, I'll hire you for my daughter's wedding, and I'll hire you for this or what that. And so when the transit stop was going to be put in, the land became extremely valuable. And so everything that was there was going to be torn down, and a high-rise parking structure would be put up and with a big sign that said Mariachi Plaza, but there'd be no mariachis. And the dialogue, the community had to really organize to say, yeah, we understand, we do want housing, we do want people that will spend money and support services, and people with money can, you know, the people that wanted to live near these transit stops, a lot of them had cars already, and they didn't need the transit stops the way the poor population that had been there for a very long time, generations, needed those transit stops. So the community dialogue process is important. Nobody gets exactly what they want in that process. And I think respectful listening is going to be, is extraordinarily important. I have been to many public meetings, but usually most of mine deal with human illness. And very early in my career, going into the high school gymnasium where the wrestlers, somebody's had meningitis and died, and we're meeting with the hundreds of parents and very panicked parents, they scared the hell out of me. And beforehand, I was not prepared for it. Nobody in medical school taught me how to deal with it. And there, without being flippant, it's just what you think. You have to have authority. You can't. So one of the things I teach my medical students is don't talk medical jargon, but put enough terms in there so that people understand you. So yeah, I'm worried about pertussis, which is whooping cough. I'm worried about whooping cough, but you have to keep your authority, but also be open to the wisdom that you're getting from the community, because the folks that have lived there have much more than you do. Secondly, and this is around cancer clusters, there are community engagement folks that do a much better job than people like me. You know, I didn't learn this in medical school. And you have to depend on professionals that know how to do this. You know, it sounds silly, but your vocabulary as you're meeting people and your tone of respect towards them is extraordinarily important. And because I grew up in Jersey, when I get defensive, I get flippant and a little bit snotty and I don't like myself. So you have to learn those lessons.
Yeah. No, it's really helpful. I think, and also you mentioned, I thought that was really insightful. Like a key takeaway might be that environmental impact statements need to be expanded and thought about, add in human health factors and other variables that might allow us to understand them as tools that are more comprehensive or more holistic. I mean, even that subtle hack could be, you know, have substantial change in terms of how community dialogues are getting the information they need to make decisions for their own, you know, public benefit. Those are important ideas as well.
One is health impact assessments are a tool where you can actually look much more prospectively at overall good. And they're very explicit about, you know, every medicine you take has a long list of bad things that can happen if you do it. And, you know, it's right there, but you also have to lay out, these are the benefits you get at the same time. We don't capture the benefits adequately when we do the environmental impact assessments, I would argue. The second big one, and maybe we could talk a little more later on, is tax policy, because now I'm a little California focused, but we have the, you know, the Jarvis Gan Prop 13 thing where you could be living next door to somebody and they're paying six times less tax than you are because they've lived there 25 years longer than you have. But what that does is it creates an incentive for buildings to stay vacant for too long. I know you do have it in Massachusetts. We have it in California. We don't have enough housing, particularly for people who are economically struggling. And the only thing worse than bad housing is no housing at all. And this has got to be a very high priority. And we haven't even gotten into transportation, but sidebar of tax policy is, in my state, you can design the most lovely downtown you'd want up in the wine country. And if the Board of Supervisors hears that they want to put in a big box store or an auto mall, they're going to go for that because the tax revenue from those are much bigger than what you'd get from a bunch of mom and pop stores downtown.
You know, it's really interesting to hear the conversation. And again, these different scales, the scale of what is it that we can do for health at the scale of the building, at the scale of the neighborhood, the scale of the region, the big infrastructure? I remember years ago when Dick and I first were working, we met probably about 20 years ago and in Atlanta. I was really pushing like, okay, look, you got the Surgeon General to put the warning on cigarettes. These cigarettes are bad for your health. I want that on zoning codes that are requiring too much driving or too much income segregation, all of these different things. And the answer you and Howie gave was, well, it took us 20 years to build up the data on cigarettes to get to that warning. I do think when the Surgeon General puts out a warning, people really do listen. And the authority that you're referring to, Dick, of saying if you're at a public meeting, yes, I'm listening, but I also have expertise and making sure that people understand that. It's been 20 years now. We've got more data. I still want that warning. This zoning code might be dangerous to your community's health. I think there's a lot we could be doing.
Surgeon General's report was 1963, and we didn't ban tobacco in the New York restaurants until about 2003. It takes a lot of work.
Are you saying that we're still working on it?
We have to.
Okay.
And the other thing about this is you get bored with yourself, but you have to say the same thing over and over again.
Well, I'd like to add something there too. I mean, I think, and this is a testament to both of you, and thanks for that question, but you know, you also have to say something that's legible and understandable by a vast audience of people. So, I mean, you, for example, you said something really provocative and I think powerful, which absence of tree coverage killed this individual. You know, being able to link direct impact to what might be called an indirect, you know, set of variables is, I think, one of the challenges that we face. You know, how can you, well, prove it to me? Well, look, here's the data, actually. There's direct, you know, health outcomes of our individual lives that we can track to something as hard to calculate as the coverage of trees. And if you can make those connections and communicate it in an effective way, you might be able to push policy forward in a more productive way. And I think you're doing that in your teaching, in your literature, in your thinking. So it's really powerful and meaningful. I want to commend you for that.
Well, and I think, you know, Michael, you're doing it too. I mean, I think So if I think of design as preventive health, you know, this is, we can, there are things we can do as designers at these different scales to prevent the health problems in the first place. I'd be interested to see how both of you would rank what is kind of the low-hanging fruit, what's easier to do and what's harder to do. You know, Michael, you focused our attention a lot on breathing, you know, the importance of what we breathe. How do we breathe clean air, not get infected? Drinking comes up as a pretty fundamental issue. Walking and socializing. And ideally, if we're healthy, we're certainly able to breathe, drink, walk, and socialize. And certainly, Michael, in your work, I see all of that just, I think, very much emphasized. But, you know, do you see a ranking? What's easier? What do we need to be pushing more? What should the students in the audience take away, either at the scale of the building or at the larger scales?
I say this fully in reverence to my mentor, Paul Farmer, who really taught me to think of it this way. I think we need to ground it even deeper into fundamental rights as citizens. You know, and that we talk about the right to health care. Well, you know, the buildings of medical infrastructure are a kind of indirect index for how we might get healthcare service to us, but they don't necessarily represent the right to healthcare itself. The healthcare is the program inside of the infrastructure, or one could argue is part and parcel of the infrastructure. But when you talk about breathing, and we think about the pandemic, and we think about that all of the air we're breathing right now in your homes, in your rooms, in your Zoom rooms, is mitigated and filtered through the buildings around you, suddenly the right to breathe rises up to the highest level of rights as individuals. And not everyone, and it's a right because not everyone has access to it fully. You know, some of us are not in the environments that can allow us to breathe effectively. Or, you know, Dick talked about asthma rates. We talked before the meeting about where the pandemic, where COVID really spiked, everything from prisons to nursing homes to cruise ships. That these are the areas where breathing fresh, uncontaminated air is mitigated by the facilities around us. I think with that notion that we affect the rights of individuals and that we liberate the rights of individuals, it grounds our work as designers in, I think, a much more, and not just human-centered, but citizen-driven, policy-driven set of initiatives that might influence the next generation of designers. It grounds it in a sense of necessity, and I would call kind of new essentialism, which is what we've been searching for. So we've been searching for this in such a profound way, and I think it's right in front of us now.
You know, there's a group called the Prevention Institute here in Oakland, and Larry Cohen had a great line, which is, good solutions solve multiple problems. And good ventilation, you know, smoke has been a reality, forest fire smoke, wildfire smoke has been an absolute reality where I live for the last few years especially, and it's not going away. It's going to get worse and worse. And there are many things we've got to mitigate and remove brush, but two, in our homes, a lot of people now have put in high quality air filters because, you know, I'm worried about COVID, I'm worried about smoke, I'm worried about dust mites, I'm worried about allergies. And so there, and I'm not, that's maybe a first world solution to, but I think your solution as you were building those hospitals to, I love the fact that it was about dignity, involving people from the various tribes and subsectors of the population, involving women, and the sense of ownership of the things that came out of this. And I so admire what that work, I have only scratched the surface of all the work you've done, but it's been so important.
All right, one of our PhD students is asking, redesigning cities for public health is a meaningful but very time and resource-consuming task, which can take generations. Practically, considering the contemporary urgency, what do you think will be the most promising leverage point in the built environment that we really need to harness for the biggest impact?
I love that question. That's why, when I was just talking about a rights-based conversation in design is, I think, where my argument to where we begin. You know, because as soon as we address the right to breathe or the right to, the next set of rights emerges, the right to dignity, the right to cities, the right to healthcare, they start to emerge as the kind of primary things that these previously siloed disciplines of public health, epidemiology, urban design, all are addressing at the same time. And when Dr. Jackson was talking about our ancestors, I look back at ancestors that have been influential to me, like John Snow and Florence Nightingale and Isambard Brunel and Olmsted, and the sanitation movement in the 1850s, 1860s to the end of the 19th century was a moment where urban design, epidemiology, public health were all intertwined. This design of about health outcomes. It was about reducing tuberculosis. It was about ending cholera. It was about the city was the location for the epidemic that we couldn't understand, and it was city change that would address the epidemic directly. They've been kind of separated and segregated in the 20th century, and I think we're at a moment again where we re-merge them. Like, there is precedent. Even, there's a great new Beatrice Colomina in her new book, X-Ray Architecture, talks about how the modern architecture movement was driven by ideas around public health outcomes and cleanliness, sanatoria, healthy living. A lot of the Richard Neutra buildings in LA are about, putting people outside, getting a healthy lifestyle. These things were interrelated before, and I think we need to find them merged together again. So I would just to reiterate, I think we start with rights, we show examples of how they can be combined, we show historical precedent, and then we push for policy change in our local and national dialogues. So post-pandemic infrastructure is something I think we can fight for at a local and national level, and a place where we might be able to insert bigger goals around climate change, around transportation, around equity and justice as well.
No, I think that segued so well to another question. What are the gaps in decision-making, in policy, in the way that we engage communities that makes it so difficult to implement wellness-forward environments in American cities?
I've probably given talks in every major city in the United States and every major medical center. I've always insisted that, if possible, the chief of police and the chief of the fire department be in the meeting with the mayor and the council at the same time. And I have not been bashful about using my medical training. And honest to God, the mayor always asks me about his type 2 diabetes. It's often a guy. And you have to enter the door that they open for you. And so I can then begin to argue for walking and for bikes and for parks and for green space and accessible schoolyards and healthier food options and maybe even a sugar tax, a sugar sweetened beverage tax that we have, for example, here in Berkeley, generates $250,000 a year for the school's physical activity programs as well. But I think the big one is people and the pipeline of pluripotential, that people that have cross boundary skills that can talk to this. And I tell my students, you got to go deep on something because you're not going to have credibility unless you have depth on something. But ultimately, you've got to realize that the decisions are not made in your own domain. And you're going to have to, one minute you're talking to a politician, and the next minute you're talking to a fraught member of the citizenry, and then you're talking to the police chief. By the way, my comment about the police chief, I remember being in one town, and I said, there's nothing for kids to do here, and that's why you're having all these problems. He said, I completely agree. We have to have much more social programs that engage kids so that and they're out there and learning behaviors that are healthy and useful. I want to bring up, there's a big one that's been in my mind though. We are going to be facing so many disasters as we go forward in the 21st century. And Michael brought this up. There's a discussion about 20% of the driver towards the increase, the once in a century, once in 500 hurricane now occurring once every 20 years. And North Carolina's seen plenty of this. And people have to be told, no, this is climate that's doing this. And you're told this like the 10th time. You go, this wasn't this way when I was a kid. So people are getting ready to hear a lot of this. And New York City is already looking at the big U, the bottom of Manhattan, the lower end of Manhattan, and how you put in the berms and barriers and oyster fields and other such things to slow down the flooding. And so I think there are going to be many disaster-driven, pre-disaster-driven opportunities for our discipline.
Yeah. Michael, anything to add on that? When we see your work presented, Michael, and I know this is true of any architect presenting their work, it suddenly looks like everything was so easy. You're just presenting, the built work is there. You know, what are some of the obstacles you run into?
Well, I'm not going to rattle off the obstacles. I mean, I think the the construction of our built environment is an incredibly expensive, laborious, and challenging effort, period. And I think the role of the architects and designers is to sift through and manage that and steward that process to keep the ideals in place, no matter what the constraints are at each stage of the process. So engagement is really one, not just one finite stage, it's a continuous stage, but it's one part of the challenging thing. And we're not talking about supply chain, we're not talking about material, extraction, we're not talking about labor fully, but all of those decisions that are along the construction of our built world have the potential of impact. So we've always kind of thought about taking a kind of wide angle view, which is to say, let's track impact at every stage and try to maximizing at all stages, and knowing that any infrastructural initiative will have an enormity of complexities, some contradictions, and certainly a lot of compromises. But that's why it's a sort of beautiful discipline. It's why I think Dick was mentioning how it's not only in the realm of arts and sculpture, although I certainly appreciate architecture and its sculptural effects and how we can't only talk about it as a mechanical or functional thing. I think the fact that it has to be built in the world takes so long, is so expensive, requires so much compromise, it makes it an inherently social and political discipline, which is its power and also its challenge. So the answer to that question is, I think we need a set of values that are overseeing the decisions of building infrastructure, and that those values are always sort of tapped at each stage to make sure that we are comfortable with what we do in our organization, the environmental impact, the social impact, the financial impact. We look at those values at each stage and try to be comfortable with the impacts that we're making and try to maximize them. And sometimes you have more agency than at other moments, but it is certainly always about a kind of ledger of positive impact as much as we can on the environment and on places in which we influence through the interruption of new infrastructure.
I'm going to condense one of the questions, which is about the health impact assessments, and just ask both of you, what type of research, you both said you've been searching for research, doing research, what if you could name one research topic that you would really love to see more work on? Here we are at Georgia Tech. Give us some marching orders. What should this next generation really focus on for assessing some kind of a health impact assessment type category?
One is you got to have the people, and we have to create a pipeline. And we've talked about we need a pipeline of health leaders that understand climate, for example. We need to support folks that are pluripotential, that cross disciplines, and that pipeline too. There's something else tied to that, which is every time I wanted to do something in my personal career, I was always told by some leader, there's no money for that until the damn thing goes wrong. And then suddenly they're throwing money at you saying, why didn't you take care of this already? But where I'm going with this is we have not done a good job of making the economic arguments. And so I would like to see a much better relationship with the economists and the business people that understand this side. Because so often we're said, oh, we can't afford it. And the truth is, we can't afford to fail to do something. And so making the economic arguments more effectively.
Yeah, I loved what you said about the multidisciplinarity. I think that in the collaboration between disciplines is where we have the most opportunity for structural change and breaking through some of the siloed divisions that we have. Paul Farmer did this so well. He was an anthropologist, he was a public health advocate, but ultimately he was a systems designer. Like kind of a hero before him, Florence Nightingale, she was not held to disciplinary silos. She was affecting policy, architecture, design, training programs, visualization studies. I think if we imagine the problems as things that are intractable and huge, then instead of how we solve them through our discipline, we start to encounter new opportunities and new collaborations. So when I talk about rights as the thing I'm kind of obsessed with now and breathing as a spatial right, what it gets me excited about that is that now I'm starting to think about law and the legal disciplines and new beachheads for policy change through the legal infrastructure, the litigious legal infrastructure of the United States, as possible ways that we might advance climate agenda, climate goals, as ways we might advance health goals through the built environment directly. So that gets me excited about another discipline that I never thought fully about collaborating with in really productive ways, but I get excited about that now, thinking about that post-pandemic.
Just, Michael, I've seen people become so sour when they say too narrowly in their discipline and almost feel like the parched plant that gets water when they finally can see that they can reach out to something else. And I think the whole academic, I've seen so many people not get promotions or not get tenure because they're seen as too diffuse. And in fact, the work they're doing is the work we urgently need.
It was when I was a student and I met Paul Farmer, who was a public health professional, and he's talking about buildings as healthcare problems. I never heard an architect speak about it that way. Some speak about it now, you speak about it, but I hadn't heard that in 2005, 2006, and it changed my life. And then I think he taught me even more when he started to talk about dignity and social justice through the built environment, and I started to see social policy as affected by infrastructure, physical infrastructure, in really clear and present ways. And finally, I think when I think about aesthetics and beauty and the value of how we compose our world, he too shaped the way I understand that we can't afford to not have beauty, because if we don't have it, it impinges the dignity of the people we serve. But I just think there's so much to learn about collaboration and connection across disciplines, and so many ways to re-understand what we know in our own disciplines through that work, that I hope at Georgia Tech that we can encourage that collaboration. So thanks.
Absolutely. Well, we obviously have a lot of work to do. I look forward absolutely to, I think it's inspiring to really though know that this is important work, and real, you two are both real heroes. You've certainly inspired me. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Also, thank our listeners. You've been listening to episode 25 of Redesigning Cities, the Speedwell Foundation Talks at Georgia Tech. Thank you, everybody. Till next time.